Our final speaker of the night, Mr. Lucian Greaves. His speech title is "The Satanic Plot to Dismantle Evangelical Theocratic Agenda."
We also, I'm happier now. We also, in defense of bodily autonomy, have waiver forms against corporal punishment in schools. I forget the numbers now. I knew it at the time when we started this, but I think the number's actually growing as the religious right becomes more emboldened. Those schools that allow for corporal punishment, and this is more of a religious argument than you might realize. All of the cognitive development literature, all the empirical analysis, really shows that beatings as a corrective have a detrimental effect on children. It's harmful. It's behaviorally a backward thing to do. It doesn't serve the intended function most of the time. But if you really start beating on people who advocate for these facts, or advocate for beating children, it's inevitable that sooner or later you're going to get to the religious dictums. You're going to get to this idea that you spare the rod or you spoil the child. And then you also get that crap from people who obviously aren't well-developed, well-functioning people, saying that they turned out okay and they had been beaten as children. And of course, the obvious argument is you think it's okay to beat children. You didn't turn out okay. But the most infuriating thing about all that we do, as I alluded to earlier, is that you see standards being applied to us. You see scrutiny being applied to us that is never applied to our opposition. You have us being brought into court, and it's being said that because we're politically engaged the way that we are, we can't also be a religious group, where they're not asking this of Jason Rapert, the senator, and his Holy Ghost Ministries and his tenure in Senate, and whether these two are mutually exclusive or intertwined. Is he looking for politics, or is he looking for his own personal salvation? Those types of things. These are questions we have to answer to and get dissected for. I think a good kind of illustration of that on a more crass level was when we were fighting our monument campaign in Oklahoma, and there was a miniature satanic panic in Oklahoma at the time. This idea that a satanic monument on the Capitol grounds was going to, you know, cause pedophilia and all those other, you know, was going to get up at night like the golem and start eating children and women and children and all that kind of thing. And in the midst of all of this, well, this case popped up where this Christian zealot had been watching YouTube videos related to his faith, according to news reports. And he was suspicious that his brother's friend or his roommate, I forget which, was a witch or a practicing Satanist or something like that. He picked up a large knife and he cut the guy's head off as he sat playing cards with his friend. And I was thinking, you know, if this were the other way around, you know, we probably wouldn't be around today. We would never live it down. But when you have your alert set to this kind of thing, you see how often it actually happens. And what was really fascinating about this was how nobody wanted to confront the religious motivation that was being explicitly stated by the guy who cut the guy's head off himself. They were trying to search for his motivations, even though it was well known that he was watching these superstitious videos, that he felt that this guy was a witch when he cut off his head, and that kind of thing. But remarkably, the sheriff was commenting in a press conference at the time, and he said that because the perpetrator had no known ties to ISIS or other Muslim organizations, there were also no religious implications to the murder as committed, which really shows you the blind spot to the bizarre, harmful, superstitious behavior initiated by some people deluded under this mythology. And on a more prevalent level, you see recurring stories. New York Post just posted one today about exorcism. They're always posting these stories about exorcism, and they often contain no skepticism at all They're often presented as these kind of like unsolved mysteries in search of kind of like amazing facts, is it true kind of things, rather than just a real backward, deranged superstition. And the fact of the matter is when you have your alert set for these types of things, you realize people die in the course of exorcisms all the time. People are being murdered in exorcisms, particularly children, in the United States, in the civilized world, all the time. You know, if it happens in some tribal region and a witch doctor kills somebody, people act like these are savage primitives and this is an outrage. It happens here. People search for the reason and they look past the strange superstitious religious beliefs. It happened recently in Arizona, where on a Native American reservation, a father drowned his child in the course of an exorcism. Burning, drowning, binding, and beating. These are the most common causes of exorcism death throughout the world. And it was funny, in the articles I read, not a one of them said anything about the religious beliefs of the Native American who had murdered his child. It was almost as though they were suggesting that there was some kind of racial component to it. They all mentioned that he's part of a Native American tribe, and they all talked about how backward the reservation could possibly be, but nobody was saying anything about the bizarre beliefs. And on a scarier level, we still have a fringe movement within psychotherapy in psychiatry of recovered memory therapy, which really played an instrumental role in the satanic panic of the 1980s and 1990s. If you're not aware of that, you really should look it up. Sociologists recognize this as a moral panic, where during the 1980s and 1990s, there was this fear that there were satanic cults, unseen, unheard. They were highly effective in covering up their crimes. They had mobile crematoriums. They were engaging in infant sacrifice. They were infiltrating high levels of government. It was tinfoil hat conspiracy stuff, but it made mainstream talk shows. People like Oprah, Sally Jesse Raphael, and others talked about it, and they would have these self-professed survivors who would come on, and they would tell these very emotive tales of how they recalled that they had been victimized by Satanists and recovered the memories later on. Of course, it's been found out that the tactic of recovering memories is very unreliable. It's the same way that people gain false memories of alien abduction or past lives and that type of thing. And it's memories very kind of malleable, and people can rewrite their autobiographical memory. And we have a campaign within the Satanic Temple where we really fight back against the lingering remnants of the satanic panic and the people who still practice these damaging things. We saw it come up in the Harvey Weinstein case. Honestly, there was an article that made a lot of rounds, and it was making the argument that it was tacitly making the argument that recovered memories should have been accepted in the Harvey Weinstein case, because the claim was that Harvey Weinstein's defense was claiming that the memories of his abuse were all false memories. That wasn't true, actually. There was some claims that came as recovered memory claims, which made them spurious claims, like it or not. And what really should have been the outrage that people should have focused on there was that somebody had engaged in recovered memory therapy on somebody who had been abused by Harvey Weinstein, thus delegitimizing her possibly credible claims. You don't allow cops to beat somebody during interrogation and then get a confession out of somebody and then say that the confession is invalid and say, well, this is an outrage. You know, clearly this person is guilty. We need to allow police to beat perpetrators. You just don't do that. But you can see that even given the ludicrous claims they make, they have really refined their arguments to stand as victims' rights advocates when they're not. Anyways, that may seem a little tangential, but it's a very It's a very important cause for us, and we've made some headway in getting some people to resign their licenses when we have gone to the conferences and seen them talking about the Illuminati and satanic ritual abuse and offering continuing education units for licensed professionals who come to see that kind of bullshit. But in closing, all I can really say is I haven't offered much of a hopeful message here at all, but I think if anything at this point, we really need to see what this minority movement of theocrats are doing and how they're doing it right and how we can probably use some of their tactics to our benefit and do more to align ourselves with our best interests and make sure that we don't allow ourselves to get discouraged to the point that we don't go out and vote and that we don't make our voices heard, because we really have to. We have to scream and rant and rave to the very end. We need to resist it, and we need to resist the theocratic movement till our dying breath, because if we don't, we're not going to live in a place worth living in anymore. Thank you. I don't know what the time is. I'm not going to ask questions, but you can ask questions to me. Does anybody have? Yes.
My son, who just turned 16, could not be here tonight because he has cancer. But he asked me whether I could ask you if you'd be so kind as to possibly relay a message from him to your Dark Lord.
Okay.
And the message is, judging by the actions of your followers and the work they are doing, it seems obvious to me, that is to him, it seems obvious to me that that you, Satan, that you are actually the good guy.
Yeah, well, I think roles have kind of become reversed, haven't they? And I think that's why people gravitate to us in large numbers right now. To a lot of people, I think this makes intuitive sense in a way it might not have made intuitive sense before. And they're seeing us in opposition to the theocrats. They're seeing this idea of Satan in this Miltonian sense as this icon of rebellion against tyranny, making sense as seeing, you know, just as a metaphorical shorthand, this image of God as this ultimate tyrant as embodied by the theocratic right. And it kind of contextualizes people's roles in this culture for them right now in a way that that makes Satanism a thing where it wasn't like 20 years ago. It was this radical idea that really put people off and turned them off, but people see more and more the depravity of the people who hide their crimes behind a cross. And I think that when future historians look back, they'll in part blame dipshits like Mike Pence for the birth of a new satanic era.
Yes. I've noticed a lot of similarity between, you know, the heartbeat bills, the religious freedom bills, trans bathroom bills, things like that, and they seem almost exclusively designed just to drain the resources of their counterparts so that they can throw as many out there and then get a few through. How do we deal with that in the sense of, if we don't fight it, it passes. If we do fight it, we have to put all this money into it. Like, what's the counter initiative for that in sort of emulating our opposition, like you described?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I you know, that's something we think about a lot. And for those who didn't hear it, the idea being that, you know, these Project Blitz model legislation bills, they're trying to wear us down. And that's actually part of the written agenda of Project Blitz. It says in the Project Blitz playbook, which was, as I said, released. You can find it online. There's a great website called blitzwatch.org, which really keeps a close watch on this. And it's sponsored by a lot of different organizations, like the Freedom From Religion Foundation, American Atheists, American Humanist Association, maybe. A lot of those, though, a lot of the secular movements, keeping a watch on it. And, you know, the idea within the Project Blitz playbook put forward by the Congressional Prayer Caucus and wall builders and those organizations themselves is that it doesn't necessarily matter if these bills pass or not. It's a symbolic victory just to even have the debate about it. Nonetheless, we do need to fight it every time. I think their symbolic victory comes in the fact that people get worn out by it and stop fighting it. And I think we need to find new ways to make it hurt, you know. And we need, one of the most infuriating parts of this is to see somebody like Senator Jason Raybert in Arkansas calling us a fake movement, a fake religion, and that kind of thing. When we're putting our own finances, our own resources, going out there under threat of death to go to depositions, and just to have him sitting in his air-conditioned office at the taxpayers' largesse, you know, spending that money to fight his crusade. And I really do think when it comes to things like these theocratic bills, there should be a little test put to them. And if you can expect a lawsuit regarding its constitutionality and you can't prove a compelling state interest for the legislation, which would have to go beyond honoring heritage and history, then I think there should be financial repercussions on the sponsor of the bill themselves. I think then you'd really see that change. That doesn't help us now with the Baphomet campaign, but we did think of something else. We always said we didn't want our monument up so long as if the Ten Commandments monument wasn't there. We viewed the Ten Commandments monument as kind of completing our monument to symbolize pluralism and government viewpoint neutrality and First Amendment values. However, this has gotten so bitter and contentious, and now we see that even if the Ten Commandments monument comes down, it's probably considered a win for Jason Raybert, his National Association of Christian Lawmakers, the Congressional Prayer Caucus. They're going to be happy that they've had it up for a couple of years. They're going to be refer to the injustice of it being taken down all this time, and he's going to play a hero to his base. If it comes to the time, when it comes to the time, a trial is set for July, when the court asks what remedy we could possibly be seeking, we're going to make the argument that the Ten Commandments monument comes down, but the Baphomet monument goes up for an equal amount of time that the Ten Commandments monument was there, and we give the full thanks to that little Jason Raybert every day for allowing that to happen. We want that to be the worst PR move he ever made, and we want that to strike fear into the hearts of other people presenting that type of bill. That, to us, would be the best outcome we could hope for right now, but we definitely are trying to keep our mind on ways we can really make this hurt the people who push these bills and advocate for these agendas. Anybody else?
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering, you mentioned how the opposition would say, like, oh, well, if you're doing, you know, involved in politics, that means you're not really have these beliefs. So if you're involved in legal things, then that's really what you're about. But I was wondering, there are all these different campaigns that you're doing, and you have community building, and you have all these legal fights, and how do all those things support your, like, mission and beliefs, and how do you find a balance between all these different things that you're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, the question is, like, how do we balance kind of these things that might seem to be mutually exclusive, the politics, the building of communities with chapters, and that kind of thing. I mean, from our end, we see it just all rolled up into one wad. You know, our communities are communities that get together to talk about how they engage with the bigger world on these types of things. These are the things they think about. They think about these bigger issues. They're concerned about the direction things are going in deference to their tenets, in deference to their deeply held beliefs. And I really don't think you can separate your core foundational fundamental beliefs from your politics. That's simply asking too much. I know we like to pretend that people can do this out of some sense in polite society that it's just bad form to question somebody's religious beliefs in regards to their ability to be credible politicians, but I think it's high time we do that. I mean, it's high time we put more scrutiny onto the candidates as to whether they really believe this supernatural shit or not. And what are the limits of that? You know, if you really believe that the cellular basis for a fetus is ensouled from the moment of conception, that's obviously going to speak to your politics regarding reproductive rights. And do you believe these things based on any empirical evidence or just because this is received wisdom? And do we want to be the kind of society that just accepts things based upon received wisdom? I think if we pushed a little harder against politicians and stopped giving them that pass of, well, they have to say this stuff, you know, they have to appeal to the religious. You know, you can't possibly say you don't subscribe to these superstitious beliefs and still get elected today. If non-believers were a bit more assertive on this, we would see a change. We really need to stop giving people a pass. I'll take one more if there is one. Yes.
Hi, I'm just a member of PSP, so I'm happy to be here and see you in person. I have a little chat room I'm in on Discord, and we're all kind of Satanists and Satan adjacent, and we talk about topics and stuff. And I mentioned that I was coming here today, and I have a question from one of my friends. They just wanted to know what surprises you the most about Satanism today, like where we are now, and maybe what we can keep doing.
Yeah, the question is what surprises me most about Satanism today and what we can still do. You know, I mean, I guess my biggest surprise is that in a lot of ways this is played out into a best case scenario from what I could have imagined at the inception of this. In the real beginning, coming out as the public face of this Satanism seemed like a really kind of suicidal act, and I was very fatalistic about it, and I didn't really have a desire to be a public figure or any of that. You can see that in the film Hail Satan. Originally I thought maybe I could coach other people to do interviews and stuff like that, but I was, you know, it just doesn't cut it. You need to be able to do these things in real time. You know, you need to be able to confront the questions and jump in on the debates, and you need to actually be impassioned about the issues and that type of thing. But it was really gratifying to me to see how quickly we got from what I thought was the best case scenario articles, which were ones that said we had a point, you know. Those, you know, I thought were the best we could hope for. We'd make our arguments like in Oklahoma or whatever, and soon we started seeing editorials being written saying, like, you might not like these guys, but this is what religious liberty is. This is what the First Amendment stands for. And we need to be willing to tolerate that in a democratic society. I thought that was great when I first saw it, and it was not long after I actually started seeing articles where editorials were willing to come out in our favor and not even suggest that we were bad people or that we shouldn't be doing what we were doing, but that we actually had the ethical high ground. And I think that's one way in which the internet helped. There's been a lot of, you know, regression, I think, with now kind of Facebook political targeted marketing and that type of thing. But and on articles at the time, I think writers were emboldened by seeing people in comments, people who could otherwise be anonymous, saying, you know, coming out in our favor. So I think that moved a lot faster than it would have in just the print media era. And now seeing just how our chapters develop individual cultures of their own, and to see this kind of non-theistic religious culture emerge, and to see things like ritual being important to them, and the way, you know, these communities construct themselves and the way they interact with one another without top-down guidance on how that is, because the only real guidance we offer is you can't do this because it's off message, you can't do this because there's legal liability. We're just kind of there to say no, you know? But we like to put the burden on us to say why not, rather than make the chapter say why. So it's just interesting to see what comes from that. And having traveled around and seen different chapters and just seeing the kind of groups that have emerged and how they interact with their communities and with each other, that has been really gratifying. And just meeting people when I'm on the road touring about and talking with people who tell me that they never felt they had a sense of community and never would, and certainly never thought they would engage with anything that they considered a religion, you know, but really finding their sense of identity with us, that's really gratifying. People who felt marginalized because of who they are. We have a lot of sex workers within the Satanic Temple. We have a lot of trans people. We immediately had a large population within the LGBTQ community. And to me, it's not mysterious as to why. They felt early on very disowned by traditional religious organizations and outcast, and explicitly, in many cases, they are. And we're explicitly inclusive and welcoming to those communities. And to me, it's like, you know, I mean, I'm hoping if I die peacefully one day and I'm laying there and thinking back, that will be what I'm most proud of in my life, is that I've helped create something to give people that sense of belonging, people who thought they would never have that. So, thank you.